3. Enough with the plastic straws. 1. The final straw. In summer 2015, a PhD student studying marine biology was in a boat off the coast of Costa Rica, scraping parasites off a sea turtle's back when she noticed something stuck up its nose. Christine Figener, then 31 years old, took out her video camera and asked a colleague to try to pull out the object. "Okay, I'm filming. You can go for it," she says. "He's going to be so happy." As her colleague uses a pair of pliers to pull on the object, the turtle sneezes. "Have you ever heard a turtle sneeze?" she asks. "You know what this is?" the colleague asks. "Brain?" another man answers. "That's a worm," he replies. "Oh, that is disgusting," says Figener. "Oh my God." The turtle writhes in pain as the researcher pulls on a thin gray object with a pair of pliers. "What the fuck?" says Figener. Blood dribbles from the turtle's nostril. "Oh, she's bleeding," says Figener. "Is it a hookworm?" "I think it's a tube worm," answers the man pulling on the object. The turtle opens its mouth as though it wants to bite someone and hisses. "I'm sorry, little one, but I think you'll like it better afterwards," Figener says. "I don't want to pull it too hard. I don't know what's attached to it," the man says. "I understand that," Figener says. "I mean, it's bleeding already. Maybe it's in her brain already." "Eso es un gusano," says one of the deckhands in Spanish. "That's a worm." "Sí," says Figener. Later, the man says, "Es una concha rara." "It's a strange kind of shell." After pulling out part of the object, they debate how hard to pull on the partially removed object as blood drips down the boat wall. Finally, the man says, "Es plástico." "It's plastic." "Is it a straw?" "Don't tell me it's a freaking straw," Figener says. "Because in Germany we have those with a black stripe." "Es un pajilla," interrupts the man. "It's a plastic straw." "A straw! A plastic straw!" Figener says. "Yelo morti y es plástico," the man says. "I bit it and it's plastic." "Didn't we have this discussion the other day about how useless freaking straws are?" Figener asks. "So this is the reason why we do not need plastic straws." They return to pulling on the straw. "I'm so sorry, baby," Figener tells the turtle. "I just wonder how she can breathe properly with that shit inside her." The turtle hisses and wriggles in pain. At 8 minutes into the video, we hear a suction sound as the researcher yanks the rest of the plastic straw free from the turtle's nose. "Ah, man," says Figener. "Show me, please." In the final seconds of the video, blood drips from the turtle's nose. When Figener returned home that night, she uploaded her video to YouTube. Within 2 days, millions had seen it. By 2020, the video had over 60 million views. Not long after Figener's video went viral, the city of Seattle announced a ban on plastic straws, followed shortly afterward by Starbucks, American Airlines, and the city of San Francisco. In the months and years since, people told her that they had reduced their use of plastic, including straws. "I'm of course happy," she said later. "Everyone can do something at home, even if it's one thing." Perhaps, but when you consider that just 0.03% of the 9 million tons of plastic waste that ends up in oceans every year is composed of straws, banning them seems like a profoundly small thing, indeed. 2. The persistence of plastic. When I spoke to Figener by phone in late 2019, she told me that bans on plastic straws were a great first step and conversation starter, but it will not fix our problems. A lot of the stuff I find in the ocean are single-use plastics, styrofoam, to-go cups, plastic bags. The reason that I had this turtle rescue on camera was because I had been working with turtles for 13 years, and plastic has been a constant byline to my work, said Figener, who earned a PhD in marine biology at Texas A&M University in 2019. plastic waste can significantly increase sea turtles' mortality rates. Half of all sea turtles have eaten plastic waste, and in some parts of the world, 80 to 100% have consumed plastic waste. Ingested plastic can kill turtles by reducing their ability to digest food, as well as by rupturing their stomach. They ingest entire plastic bags, Figener said, but they also ingest smaller 5 to 10 centimeter pieces that, in some of their stomachs, can cause obstructions, perforations, and can lead to starvation and internal bleedings. Scientists in 2001 found that debris, mostly plastic, accounted for 13% of green turtle deaths that were studied off the coast of Brazil. In 2017, scientists found that once a sea turtle had 14 pieces of plastic in its gut, it had only a 50-50 chance of surviving. It's not just turtles. In spring 2019, a dead sperm whale was found in Italy, with more than 48 pounds of plastic tubing, dishes, and bags in its stomach. Most of the plastic was undigested and intact. It may have killed her fetus, which experts said was in an advanced state of decomposition. 1 month earlier, scientists in the Philippines found a beached whale with 88 pounds of plastic in its body. In 2018, scientists in Spain found 60 pounds of plastic trash in a dead sperm whale. For every pound of tuna we're taking out of the ocean, we're putting 2 pounds of plastic in the ocean, an ocean scientist reported. Seabird populations have declined 70% since 1950. Essentially, seabirds are going extinct, a leading scientist said. Maybe not tomorrow, but they're headed down sharply. Plastic is one of the threats they face. Seabirds can eat up to 8% of their weight in plastic, which is the equivalent to the average woman having the weight of 2 babies in her stomach, noted another scientist. The share of seabird species ingesting plastic rose from 5% in 1960 to an estimated 90% in 2012, with the scientists studying the issue predicting an increase to 99% of species found with ingested plastic by 2050. Part of the reason we worry about plastics is that it seems to take so long for them to degrade. In 2018, the United Nations Environment Program estimated that styrofoam takes thousands of years to disintegrate. 3. The poverty of waste. Consumption of plastics has skyrocketed during the last several decades. Americans use 10 times as much per capita as we did in 1960. Between 1950 and 2015, we went from producing 2 million tons of this stuff to nearly 400 million tons globally. Scientists estimate that the amount of plastic waste could increase tenfold between 2015 and 2025. One study found that just 4 developing nations, China, Indonesia, Philippines, and Vietnam, produce half of all mismanaged plastic waste at risk of entering the ocean. 1/4 came from China alone. The vast majority of plastic waste in the marine environment comes from land-based sources like littering, manufacturing materials, and waste associated with coastal recreational activities. The rest comes from ocean-based debris like fishing nets and lines. Fishing nets and lines account for half of all waste within the infamous Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Figener reports finding ghost nets swimming in our oceans, rice bags and other big debris where turtles can become entangled. Recycling isn't really working, Figener explains. We're not really recycling. When we do, it is kind of a downcycling, not an upcycling. Eventually, you know, recycling with plastics, unlike aluminum or glass, happens a few times, if at all, before it ends up in landfills. In the United States in 2017, nearly 3 million tons of plastic waste were recycled, 5.6 million tons were incinerated, and almost 27 million tons were sent to landfills. Comparing 2017 to 1990, Landfill and incineration amounts have doubled, while plastic recycling amounts increased eightfold. More than 25 million tons of plastic waste were produced in Europe in 2014, with 39% incinerated, 31% sent to landfills, and 30% recycled. Even though you put it in your recycling bin, that doesn't mean it stays here in the U.S., said Figener. It actually gets shipped to China and Asia, Indonesia and Malaysia, other countries that do not have the infrastructure to deal with all that waste. In 2017, China abruptly announced that it would no longer accept large quantities of plastic waste from rich nations like the United States. At the time, China was importing $18 billion worth of solid waste. China's rejection of waste was part of a broader health and environmental effort. A few months later, Malaysia had replaced China as the world's solid waste dump, but its sixfold increase in solid waste imports in less than 1 year aroused domestic opposition. "Everybody knows those dumps are illegal," a Malaysian butcher told the New York Times. "We don't like them." Other countries seem less willing to accept waste. Vietnam announced it would stop importing plastic scrap waste by 2025. The Philippines refused to allow in a shipment of a plastic waste-based fuel from Australia in spring 2019 for reasons that included its terrible smell. That doesn't mean developed nations are off the hook. Even in fastidious Japan, where 70 to 80% of used plastic bottles, bags, and wrappers are collected and incinerated or recycled, 20,000 to 60,000 tons of plastic still ends up in the ocean. After two decades of growth in recycling, even in rich countries, less than a third of plastic waste is recycled. Figener, who is from Germany, which incinerates much of its waste, notes that Germany still recycles, you know, in quotation marks, and we're still one of those that export our recycling to countries in Asia and Africa. We only incinerate those things that don't have a value anymore on the recycling market. The biggest factor in determining whether waste ends up in the ocean or not is whether a nation has a strong waste collection and management system. As such, if the concern is about plastic ending up in the ocean, nations will likely need to focus on either storing waste in landfills or incinerating it. The experiences of American cities in the 1980s, starting up recycling systems, tell us that the processing equipment and collection practices come at a massive premium over refuse collection, up to 20 times the cost per ton. Ultimately, it's just cheaper for plastic makers to simply produce new plastic resin from petroleum. For low-income countries which have collection rates of less than 50%, the transition from the open dumping toward efficient collection and sanitary landfilling should be the first step. A well-managed refuse and landfill system can cost 10 times more than open dumping, yet will be necessary to avoid river and ocean pollution. Many experts thus believe that rich nations seeking to reduce plastic waste in the oceans should improve trash collection in poor ones. "Improving waste management infrastructure in developing countries is paramount," wrote the authors of a major study in 2015. "Doing that would require substantial infrastructure investment, primarily in low- and middle-income countries." 4. Things fall apart. Between 2007 and 2013, a team of 9 scientists took 24 separate expeditions around the world to try to determine the total amount of plastic in the sea. They went to all 5 subtropical gyres, circular currents in the oceans that trap plastic waste. They towed nets behind boats 680 times to scoop up waste, which they separated from natural debris using microscopes, before counting and weighing to the nearest 0.01 milligram. They visually surveyed waste 891 times, and they even developed a model of how plastic waste spreads across the ocean, accounting for how the wind mixes plastic vertically. The scientists seemed shocked by what they discovered. The global weight of plastic pollution on the sea surface, from all size classes combined, is only 0.1% of the world annual production. Even more astonishing, they found 100 times less microplastic than they had been expecting to find. So where are all the microplastics going? The scientists named several possibilities. First, as large plastic gets broken down into smaller and smaller particles, they start degrading ever more rapidly because the volume relationship is increased dramatically and oxidation levels are higher, enhancing their biodegradation potential. Second, the sea life eating plastic waste appear to be packaging microplastics into fecal pellets, thus enhancing sinking. While eating plastic can negatively impact the health of seabirds and mammals, it appears to also be contributing to the removal of small microplastics from the sea surface. In the end, the scientists emphasized how much we still don't know. The question, where is all the plastic, remains unanswered. They concluded, highlighting the need to investigate the many processes that play a role in the dynamics of macro, meso, and microplastics in the world's oceans. 5 years later, another group of scientists offered another possibility, at least for one of the most vexing forms of plastic waste, polystyrene, the plastic used in styrofoam, plastic utensils, and endless other products. In 2019, a team of scientists from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts and Massachusetts Institute of Technology announced that it had discovered that sunlight breaks down polystyrene in ocean water over a period as short as decades. It had long been known that sunlight breaks down plastics like polystyrene. Just look at plastic playground toys, park benches, or lawn chairs, said one of the scientists, which can rapidly become sun-bleached. But environmental groups have long considered polystyrene waste in the ocean to have a lifespan in the thousands of years, if not longer, because it can't be broken down by bacteria. Therefore, even though polystyrene represents a small percentage of global plastic, its long life in nature was considered an environmental threat, one easily visualized as chunks of styrofoam bobbing on waves and beaches. In a lab, the scientists exposed 5 samples of polystyrene in seawater to light from a special lamp matching the sun's rays. What they discovered was that sunlight breaks down the polystyrene into organic carbon and carbon dioxide. The organic carbon dissolves in seawater, and the carbon dioxide enters the atmosphere. At the end of the process, the plastic is gone. We used multiple methods, and they all pointed to the same outcome, said one of the researchers. The same molecular property that made polystyrene molecules hard for microbes to eat was just the feature that made them vulnerable to having their bonds broken by sunlight. The scientists said their study was the first to provide direct proof of how and how fast sunlight breaks down polystyrene, first into microplastics, then into individual molecules, and then into its elemental building blocks. One of the best pieces of good news to emerge from the study was that certain additives used to shape the flexibility, color, and other qualities of polystyrene can speed up or slow down its disintegration by sunlight in water. That discovery opens up the possibility of modifying how we make plastics to allow for a more rapid disintegration. 5. The elephant in the room. For thousands of years, humans around the world made exquisite jewelry and other luxury items from the shells of hawksbill sea turtles, like the kind studied by Figener and her crew in Costa Rica. Craftsmen heated the turtles over a fire, sometimes alive, so they could peel the misnamed tortoise shell away from their skeletons. Sometimes the deshelled sea turtles were returned to the sea. Scientists estimate that since 1844, humans have killed 9 million hawksbill turtles, or about 60,000 each year. humans killed so many hawksbills that the dramatic reduction in the species altered the function of coral reef and seagrass ecosystems around the globe. Around the world, artists and artisans used heat to flatten and mold tortoise shell into various luxury items, including eyeglasses, combs, lyres, jewelry, boxes, and, at least in Japan, penis rings, penis sheaths, and condoms. Tortoiseshell was considered valuable in ancient Rome. Julius Caesar was thus overjoyed when, after invading Alexandria, Egypt, he discovered warehouses filled with the material. He went on to make the tortoiseshell a symbol of his victory. What was special about the shell of sea turtles wasn't just that it is smooth and beautiful, but also that it was so plastic, which originally referred to things that were easily molded or shaped. Tortoiseshell consists of keratin, a durable protein that protects cells from stress and damage. Keratin also comprises nails, horns, feathers, and hooves. Tortoiseshell is special in that it can be peeled into thin sheets to create veneer while remaining hard and water-resistant. When broken, it can even be repaired through the reapplication of heat and pressure. Like tortoiseshell, the ivory tusks of elephants were prized for their beauty and plasticity in making artistic and luxury items, including combs, piano keys, and billiard balls. The ancient Greek sculptor Phidias created a 30-foot statue of Athena, daughter of Zeus and goddess of war, from gold and ivory. It was displayed for many years inside the Parthenon. In the Middle Ages, ivory was used to make caskets, goblets, and handles for swords and trumpets. Demand for ivory increased greatly in the 19th century as the material came to be used at an industrial scale. Americans, in particular, loved the material. From the 1830s to the 1980s, one of the largest ivory processing plants in the world was in Essex, Connecticut. It processed up to 90% of all ivory imported into the United States. Concerns about ivory shortages rose shortly after the American Civil War ended. Dealers in ivory expressed considerable alarm lest the supply of elephants should run short in a few years, reported the New York Times in 1866, and so throw them out of business. The reporter estimated 22,000 elephants were being killed each year just to supply the cutlery establishments of Sheffield, England, with handles for the knives and other cutlery made there. Already, demand for ivory billiard balls had outpaced the available supply. For some articles, billiard balls, for instance, made from ivory, no substitute for that material has been found, reported the Times. A large dealer in billiard stock has offered a reward of several hundred dollars to any person who will produce a substance from which billiard balls can be made as durable and cheaper than ivory ones. As yet, no one has responded. 7 years later, in 1873, a reporter for the Times was despondent that a viable substitute for ivory would be found. Think of the silence in the land, unless we could get ivory to make our piano keys with. The reporter estimated that U.S. ivory demand resulted in the killing of 15,000 elephants. Later, a Times reporter estimated that the British imports resulted in the killing of 80,000 elephants annually. Rising prices had encouraged entrepreneurs to look for alternatives. The high price of ivory, together with its liability to warp and shrink, have led to numerous efforts to find some good substitute for the article. Those included walrus and hippopotamus teeth, and the albumen of palm trees grown in the Andes, which was already being used to make rosaries, toys, and crucifixes. In 1863, in upstate New York, a young man named John Wesley Hyatt learned about the billiard ball maker's offer of a $10,000 reward to anyone who could create a suitable substitute to ivory, and he started experimenting in his backyard shed with various materials. 6 years later, he had invented celluloid from the cellulose in cotton. By 1882, the New York Times warned of rising prices. During the last quarter of a century, ivory has been steadily increasing in price. Until now, it is selling at more than double its cost 20 years ago. Europe and the United States were consuming 2 million pounds of ivory annually, which represented about 160,000 elephants. A prominent ivory merchant, who is a pessimist on the subject of the scarcity of ivory, was recently heard to declare that it was his conviction that ivory would eventually grow to be so rare that in generations to come, an ivory ring would be looked upon as one of the most costly gifts which a wealthy suitor could place upon the hand of his betrothed. A similar dynamic occurred with tortoiseshell. After Japan opened up to foreign trade in 1859, cheap, mass-manufactured products came into the country from Europe. As Japan industrialized along Western patterns, notes a historian, plastics replaced tortoiseshell for many of its uses, including the production of hair ornaments. Combs were one of the first and most popular uses for celluloid. For thousands of years, humans had made combs of tortoiseshell, ivory, bone, rubber, iron, tin, gold, silver, lead, reeds, wood, glass, and porcelain. Celluloid replaced most of them. By the late 1970s, ivory was no longer used for piano keys. While some musicians claimed a fondness for ivory keys, most asserted the superiority of plastic. "I was glad to see it go," a quality control manager for a piano keyboard maker told the New York Times in 1977. The tusks had to be handled very carefully to prevent disease. The plastic covering we use today is a far superior product in terms of its durability. And it's not the case that plastic was uglier. The best ivory has no grain and looks just like plastic. Celluloid had the advantage of being colored in ways to imitate the distinctive marbling of tortoiseshell combs. Hyatt produced a pamphlet boasting of the product's environmental benefits, claiming it will no longer be necessary to ransack the earth in pursuit of substances which are constantly growing scarcer. In our conversation after I told Figener the history of how plastic helped save the hawksbill turtle, she laughed. "Plastic is a miracle product, you know? I mean, the advances in technology that also, you know, helped to develop. It wouldn't be possible without plastic. I mean, I don't want to lie about it. I'm not that hardline on it." 6. The Real Killers. In September 2019, Helen and I traveled across the South Island of New Zealand for vacation. We didn't have enough time to see both the glowworms and the island's rare penguins, so we opted for the penguins. Before heading for the visitor's center, we stopped for lunch at the diner our guidebook had recommended. Fish and chips were on the menu. Americans don't know how to cook fish and chips well, and I had never enjoyed eating them until I had some in Britain a few years earlier. "I bet the fish and chips are good here," I said, checking Helen's face for agreement. She nodded, and we ordered it. The fish, a blue cod, was delicious. It had been perfectly fried in a light batter. I devoured most of it, while Helen ate fish stew. Within the hour, we were at Penguin Place, a private farm that protects the nesting sites of yellow-eyed penguins. The farm's owner had created extensive trenches with blinds so tourists could spy on the penguins without scaring them. The trenches traversed roughly 1 kilometer over the hillside near the undeveloped coast. They were about 5 feet deep and were shielded with green blinds. I hadn't read anything about the penguins in advance because I was on vacation and just wanted to enjoy the scenery. But before the tour, our guide started explaining how imperiled the species was. A chart plastered on the wall behind our guide showed the population of the island's yellow-eyed penguins. It hovered between 300 and 400. When he started talking about causes for the penguins' decline, the room of tourists fell quiet, and I started to fill with dread. "There were several causes," he explained. "Invasive species, including the stoat, a kind of weasel, as well as dogs and cats, ate the penguins. But the biggest threat of late," he said, "was that penguins were underweight. They weren't getting enough to eat." "Oh, no," I thought. "No, no, no." I knew where this was headed. "The big problem," said our guide, here it comes, I thought, was from people overfishing the areas where the penguins feed. And what kind of fish do the penguins prefer? I could have said the words before he did. Blue cod. How depressing, I thought. We had literally eaten the poor penguin's lunch. Penguin Place had started taking penguins into captivity for the sole purpose of fattening them up. They can only stay here for 3 months, our guide said, because if they stay longer, they get sick and die. What exactly happens to them? I asked. The guide said that they are greatly stressed by being around people, and the stress appears to make them susceptible to falling ill from some kind of bacteria that is already in their bodies. The International Union for Conservation of Nature's IUCN authoritative red list classifies the yellow-eyed penguin as endangered, with its population declining. It estimates that between 2,528 to 3,480 birds total live in the wild. Other major threats to the penguins are lack of habitat. Most of the area where the penguins nest have been taken over by ranches and farms, invasive predators, and being caught by fishermen. Its population has undergone extreme fluctuations, notes the IUCN, and has potentially undergone a very rapid decline over the past three generations, 21 years, as a result of ongoing threats such as invasive predators and fisheries bycatch, which means being accidentally killed by fishermen. Warmer oceans from climate change might also be sending fish deeper in the ocean, requiring the penguins to dive deeper, expend more energy, and worsen their malnutrition. The first yellow-eyed penguin we saw was in captivity. He was there getting fattened up with fish. Our guide told us to be absolutely quiet so as not to alarm him. He was resting on a piece of wood in a yard. He was distinctive and beautiful, with the yellow around his eyes forming a kind of mask. Our group of roughly 30 people peeked over the fence, our cameras making all kinds of noise. I don't know the first thing about penguins, but he looked stressed. We boarded two school buses and drove to the entrance of the trenches. With an A-frame of green material shielding our heads and walls of earth on both sides of us, it felt like we were entering the underworld. After walking a half kilometer or so through the trenches, our guide pointed to a lone penguin roughly 200 yards away, just standing there. And roughly 50 yards in almost the opposite direction was a couple. The yellow-eyed penguins are not only deeply afraid of people, they fear each other. The couple was protecting an egg and barely moved. As we watched them, the guide explained that they had tagged and named all of the birds. On the walls inside the trench, the scientists had posted laminated sheets describing each of the birds and a photo to identify them. Given how endangered they are, Penguin Place closely tracks their reproductive success. Tash, a 15-year-old female, had successfully raised 7 chicks. Jim, a 25-year-old male, had raised 21, but Tosh, whose photo showed him looking down and to his left, perhaps a bit dejected, had not raised a single chick, despite being 16 years old. There was a gay couple among the penguins, our guide told us. The scientist had given them an egg, which they successfully hatched into a chick and raised as their own. Afterward, we went to the local visitor center to watch a video and read the exhibits. On the wall was an image of a decaying body of a dead albatross seabird, its stomach filled with plastic garbage. But one of the exhibit's videos indicated the major causes of albatross mortality were fishing boats and invasive predators, not plastic. The video was accurate. In the 1970s and 1980s, fishermen had used long fishing lines with thousands of baited hooks. The albatrosses would eat the bait and get snagged by the hook and die. Rabbits, cows, pigs, and cats have negatively impacted the albatross population as well, and scientists believe cats and pigs caused the local extinction of the southern royal albatross on Auckland Island, while also preventing the species' return. As for climate change, if it were the only threat to the species, scientists say, the penguins would likely be okay, while at least one species of albatross does better in warmer water. Unlike climate change, these factors could be managed on a regional scale, one of the penguin scientists noted. In 2017, scientists published research finding that illegal fishing bycatch overshadows climate as a driver of black-browed albatross population decline. And in contrast to the sea turtles, the scientists found that warmer sea surface temperature favors high breeding success. As many of the sea turtles scientists studied off the southern coast of Brazil were killed by fishing, as were killed by plastic waste. "We have massive losses of sea turtles to commercial fisheries and poaching," Figener explained. "Over 10 years, a little more than 500,000 olive ridley turtles have died in fishing nets, and that's just in the economic zone. And so we don't know about any of the things that happen in international waters. Probably millions of turtles die every year in fisheries." The habitat of olive ridleys, notes the IUCN, has been lost to coastal development, aquaculture ponds, and stress from a growing human population. As such, the intense media and public focus on plastic, like the intense focus on climate change, risks distracting us from other equally important, perhaps more important, threats to endangered sea life, which may be easier to address than climate change or plastic waste. For example, overfishing, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is one of the most important non-climactic drivers affecting the sustainability of fisheries. The amount of fish and fish products for human consumption has increased from 11% in 1976 to 27% in 2016, and is projected to increase an additional 20% by 2030. According to the FAO, since 1961, the average annual increase in global apparent food fish consumption, 3.2%, has outpaced population growth, 1.6%, and exceeded consumption of meat from all terrestrial animals, combined, 2.8%. According to the IUCN, 42 species of sharks are critically endangered, directly threatened by fishing. And apex predators like dolphins and sharks are slow to reproduce. Their populations cannot withstand such large losses. As for sea turtles, their direct killing by humans remains a threat. There's still a lot of countries worldwide where turtle meat, shell, fat are still consumed, said Figener. There are beaches where they take literally 100% of every egg that is laid on that beach, preventing a new generation from being produced. They also take the nests. 7. Plastic is progress. Today, Figener worries that straws distract us from dealing with the root of the problem. "I don't want the corporations to feel like they're getting off easily just by eliminating plastic straws," she added. "I hope that in 5 years' time, we don't even need to discuss plastic straws because there are too many alternatives." Figener said that in Germany, they often use glass instead of plastic. But are the alternatives to fossil-based plastics really better for the environment? Certainly not in terms of air pollution. In California, banning plastic bags resulted in more paper bags and other thicker bags being used, which increased carbon emissions due to the greater amount of energy needed to produce them. Paper bags would need to be reused 43 times to have a smaller impact on the environment. And plastic bags constitute just 0.8% of plastic waste in the oceans. Glass bottles can be more pleasant to drink out of, but they also require more energy to manufacture and recycle. Glass bottles consume 170 to 250% more energy and emit 200 to 400% more carbon than plastic bottles, due mostly to the heat energy required in the manufacturing process. Of course, if the extra energy required by glass were produced from emissions-free sources, it wouldn't necessarily matter that glass bottles required more energy to make and move. If the energy is nuclear power or renewables, there should be less of an environmental impact, notes Figener. As for bioplastics, They do not necessarily degrade faster than ordinary plastics made from fossil fuels. Some bioplastics, including cellulose, are just as durable as plastics made from petroleum products. When bioplastics biodegrade more quickly than fossil plastic, they are not reused as often as ordinary plastics, and they are more difficult to recycle. The lack of reuse and recycling infrastructure reduces the resource productivity of bioplastics, increasing both their environmental impact and economic cost. People just assume that because it's bio, it means it's somehow better, said Figener, and it's just not. I mean, it depends also on where the raw materials come from. Just because it is made from cane sugar, it is not necessarily biodegradable. A study of the life cycle of bioplastics made from sugar found higher negative respiratory health impacts, smog, acidification, carcinogens, and ozone depletion than from fossil plastics. When sugar-based bioplastics decompose, they emit more methane, a potent greenhouse gas, than fossil plastics. As a result, decomposing bioplastics often produce more air pollution than sending ordinary plastics to the landfill. And because bioplastics come from crops grown rather than the resin waste product from the oil and gas industry, they have large land use impacts just like biofuels have, from corn ethanol in the United States to palm oil in Indonesia and Malaysia, where they have destroyed habitat for the endangered orangutan, one of the great apes. Plastics are made from a waste byproduct of oil and gas production and thus require no additional land to be used. By contrast, switching from fossil plastics to bioplastics would require expanding farmland in the United States by 5 to 15%. To replace fossil plastic with corn-based bioplastic would require 30 to 45 million acres of corn, which is equivalent to 40% of the entire U.S. corn harvest, or 30 million acres of switchgrass. Figener told me she hopes that companies will develop better alternatives within 5 years. After I expressed skepticism, Figener admitted, "The pace the companies are trying to change is just too slow for me and my turtles. I'm just a little impatient, probably." 8. Waste not, want not. The plastics parable teaches us that we save nature by not using it, and we avoid using it by switching to artificial substitutes. This model of nature saving is the opposite of the one promoted by most environmentalists, who focus either on using natural resources more sustainably or moving toward biofuels and bioplastics. We must overcome the instinct to see natural products as superior to artificial ones if we are to save species like sea turtles and elephants. Consider how dangerous that instinct was in the case of the tortoise shell. Rapid economic growth made the Japanese middle class rich by global and historic standards, and it increased their desire for luxury items, including natural tortoise shell, much of which Japan sourced from Indonesia. The Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, CITES, finally banned the trade of hawksbill turtles in 1977. Japan initially refused to join the ban and only relented in 1992. Scientists estimate that during the 150 years of tortoiseshell trade, a shocking 75% of all tortoiseshell was traded during the single 15-year period between 1970 and 1985. The Japanese were responsible for a significant amount of that trade. As such, artificial substitutes are necessary but not sufficient to save wildlife like the hawksbill sea turtle and African elephants. We must also find a way to train ourselves to see the artificial product as superior to the natural one. The good news is that, to some extent, this is already happening. In many developed nations, consumers condemn the consumption of natural products, like products made from ivory, fur, coral, and tortoiseshell. Humankind is thus well prepared to understand an important paradoxical truth. It is only by embracing the artificial that we can save what's natural. Toward the end of our conversation, Christine Figener and I argued over her proposal that big companies like Coca-Cola provide the responsibility for waste management in poor nations like Nicaragua. If you have an unstable political situation, she asked me, who is going to take care of the waste management? Well, you have to have a functioning government, obviously, I said. Nicaragua is the best example, she said. I mean, how many changes of government? African countries, how many changes of government? You always want to put it back on the government, but poor countries often do not have a stable political situation. So are you going to have each company do it, rather than have a single waste management system? I asked. In those countries who don't have that many choices, most of the things are produced by either Coca-Cola or PepsiCo, or maybe Nestle. That's like two or three companies at most, so they would have to take responsibility for it. The first stepping stone might be to work together to circumvent the government, which often is corrupt. So we're going to say that because your government is so messed up, I asked, we're going to make the companies. Do you really believe that the burden should be on the government to pay for waste management that is created by companies? She asked me. Everywhere in the world we do waste collection the same, I replied. You're saying that to solve the plastic waste problem, poor countries should do it differently. I'm not sure I understand why, other than that you think the governments are corrupt. But it's still on the consumer, she said. If you think about it, it's crazy. I mean, you're paying for trash that is produced by companies, and you can't even circumvent it, because a lot of times there is no alternative. If you get Coca-Cola to pay for waste collection, are they not going to pass that cost on to the consumer in the form of higher prices? I asked. Yes. And then what, people will consume less Coca-Cola? What would be so bad about that? She asked. You want people to consume less Coca-Cola? I asked. Because I thought what you wanted was for them to have waste management. Well, that's reduction in a different kind of way, she said. Because maybe it's not just gonna be about inconvenience or convenience, right? I thought we were trying to solve the plastic waste problem, I said. I always said I want to reduce, and whatever's left over I want to have responsibly managed, she explained. But the big difference in terms of the problem we're all concerned about is whether or not you have a waste collection and management, I said. It sounds to me like your impatience has led you to look for a solution that you think will be faster and easier. Countries in Africa, Central America, and Asia are not doing such a good job having to do with the level of poverty, corruption, and the level of instability of government, said Figener. So whatever works in Europe won't always work in those countries. Though we differed over solutions, I appreciated where Figener was coming from. When I first went to Nicaragua in the late 1980s, I was horrified by the trash strewn everywhere. I remain bothered by the plastic waste I see when traveling in poor nations. As a conservationist, there are few things more demoralizing than hiking or swimming to a place of great natural beauty, only to discover plastic waste that has either been left behind by thoughtless people or has migrated there through rivers and oceans. But for the people who are often struggling to survive in poor and developing nations, there are many things more demoralizing than uncollected waste. In Delhi, India, in 2016, I visited a community right next to one of the city's main dumps. Even wearing a mask and goggles, I could hardly tolerate the putrid smell. But the people I interviewed were understandably more focused on scavenging enough scrap metals and other materials in order to eat that night than they were on the smell. Economic development brings waste management. In early 2020, China's top economic planning agency put out a 5-year plan to reduce the production and use of plastic. By the end of 2020, supermarkets, malls, and food delivery services in China's largest cities will no longer use plastic bags. Notably, China is doing so long after having created a waste collection and management system. For poor nations, creating the infrastructure for modern energy, sewage, and flood water management will be a higher priority than plastic waste, just as they were for the United States and China before them. The lack of a system to collect and manage human waste through pipes, sewers, and purification systems poses a far greater threat to human health. The lack of a flood water management system is a far greater threat to homes, farms, and public health than the lack of a waste system, as we saw in the Congo. And as the next chapter shows, the lack of a modern energy system poses one of the greatest threats to both people and endangered species in poor nations.